do we exist? Were we created with a purpose, or are we just here by chance? What are we to believe about life, faith, and worldview? Welcome to The Universe Next Door, focusing on answers to the questions we all consider. Join us as we seek to see a generation captivated and transformed by the truth of Christianity. This is The Universe Next Door.
Welcome to The Universe Next Door. I hope that you have taken the time recently to do something new and exciting and thrilling. I did that recently. My family and friends and I went up to a Sasquatch Bigfoot Museum up in North Georgia. Yes, a Bigfoot Museum. You're not going to hear about that today, but you are going to hear about it pretty soon. The reason you're not going to hear about it today is because we are going to be talking about another large myth, legend, man, hero, whatever you want to call him, love him or hate him, and that's going to be Santa Claus. So we're going to be talking about a whole bunch of questions revolving around Santa Claus, revolving around Christ. We're going to answer questions like, where did Santa Claus come from, the idea of him, how did he become what he is today, sort of this American legend slash myth slash God, perhaps. Is mythology always bad? That's something we're going to cover. Should you do Santa Claus with your kids? And what do we do with our kids? Have you thought this through? What is sort of your viewpoint on that? What are your views on the idea of Santa Claus, and how do you do it? If Santa Claus is based, of course, on a real historical figure, but has myth and legend added to him, how is Jesus any different? You know, does this accusation against Jesus that, well, yeah, Jesus of Nazareth was a real person, but he developed into quote-unquote God through myth and legend over time, does that accusation that you've probably heard from secular scholars, does that hold any water? So we have a lot to cover today. Especially this time of the year, you'll probably see stuff going around social media about all kinds of stuff related to these topics. Like, did Santa Claus come from Odin, the Greek god? Did Santa Claus punch Arius in the face at the Council of Nicaea? And honestly, I love talking about the real story of Santa Claus. Part of the reason is that he and I share the same first name. So I feel kind of this unbridled connection to and with him, almost like he's my spirit animal. And so I'm going to channel that. But in the meantime, make sure you hit follow wherever you're listening, Apple, Spotify, etc. Hit follow and hit notify. We've changed the date of when we release our episodes to Tuesday nights at 5 p.m., but we're also going to have some more content coming out here and there. I actually have a pretty exciting segment. I hinted at Bigfoot, but I have a pretty exciting segment coming out fairly soon. So that's going to be a somewhat regular thing, but all that to say, it's going to be released on a different night than Tuesday night. So hit follow and hit notify so that you're notified of when these episodes come out. All kinds of changes coming in 2024. It's going to be awesome. You don't want to miss any of it, so hit follow. And thank you so much for those of you who are new, and also for those you've been along for the ride for a while, and now we're coming to the end of another year. So that's always exciting. It goes by quick. It's a little weird, but definitely always exciting to be coming up with new stuff. So today we're going to be covering all things Santa Claus, starting with who he actually was. So again, just like most myths and legends, there's all kinds of different origin stories floating around and tying together. And there is some truth to that, to different things being tied together. But he is based on a real figure that is undoubted. It's for certain. He's based on a real figure, and that real figure is Nicholas of Myra. So Nicholas of Myra, actually have a really interesting book about him that I put in the description below. It's called St. Nicholas, Bishop of Myra. Very creative name. Obviously, they had their A-team come up with this name. And I don't know. It looks like it might have been somebody's dissertation or something like that. But very well researched. It's by D.L. Cann. It's in the description below. If you're interested in Santa Claus, which you won't be probably 2 weeks from now, I would suggest you read this. But otherwise, I've done the dirty work for you. So this is the man, Nicholas of Myra, the man that the Santa Claus we see today actually came from, developed from. Where he started was here. And it's important that you understand that. He didn't start from a Greek god. He started from Nicholas of Myra. And Nicholas of Myra, also known as St. Nicholas, he was born in a wealthy Greek family. He grew up in a city called Petar. And this is a city in the realm of Artemis worship. So there was all kinds of Greek god worship going around around him. But he didn't partake in that. So he was born around 275 AD, roughly. And just as a disclaimer here, a lot of the information about Nicholas of Myra comes from Greek tradition. It comes more from stories than it does actual sources. There are some, in a lot of these traditions that came later, some of them are reliable, some of them are like, okay, why would someone make this up? But all that to say, there's not a ton of actual solid evidence, because it's not like he was this real famous figure at the time. So a lot of what we know about him comes through stories more than anything else. And it's important to know that, because that is totally in contrast to, let's say, the person of Jesus Christ. We'll get into that later. Or the apostles, or anything scriptural. The manuscript evidence for the Bible is mind-blowing. I'll link a video in the description, or podcast in the description, from when we had Dan Wallace on. But it is mind-blowing how incredibly close to the events, the stories, and manuscripts of the stories of the Gospels, for example, are. So this isn't that. A lot of these stories come from later, slightly later, much later. But just know that going into this. So he was Greek, obviously. Name is Nicholas. Born around 275. He lost his parents to a plague. So they got sick and had passed away when he wasn't all that old. They were very wealthy, so he received a large inheritance. But as I said, he didn't engage in the Greek god worship that he was surrounded by. Rather, his parents raised him in a church in environment. They raised him on worship. They raised him on scripture. Probably was very well educated, not only because he had the money and the drive to do so, but he was led to the priesthood from an early age. He had an inclination toward generosity and kindness that was sort of instilled in him. And because of his wealth and drive toward the priesthood, like I said, it's likely that he became very well educated, or at least well educated, and enough so to become the Bishop of Myra at around 30 years old. So that's another thing he and I have in common. We're both very decent guys, good guys all around. Lots of people would say that. So there is that too. Probably not a coincidence we have the same name. But before we get to the actual story that developed into the Santa Claus, and you may have heard it before, it's really interesting. Before we do that, I wanted to point out that it's interesting that he lived through one of the most crucial points in Christian history. So he was around when Diocletian came into power. He led possibly the most brutal and the worst persecution of Christians in history, definitely in early church history. I mean, I'm talking brutal. Scholars still don't know exactly why he led this persecution. It seems kind of arbitrary. Even some of his close family and friends were Christian, so this was just kind of out of left field. But he's responsible for the deaths of many, many Christians. And Nicholas of Myra was a bishop during this time, during this brutal persecution. And he actually ended up most likely tortured and in prison for a number of years through his reign. And now keep in mind that after this, he was also doing ministry when the persecution ended and when Constantine came into the picture. And so he lived through one of the most interesting times in Christian history, from the worst persecution possibly ever, at least close to it, into one of the best periods ever for Christians at that time. So he lived through this transition from Diocletian to Constantine. And as we'll get into in a minute, this is why a lot of people think he was at the Council of Nicaea, interestingly enough. So very interesting time to live, incredible life, worst and best times of church history. So he was alive during this time, and there is a very famous story that kind of sparked the whole Santa Claus thing. I'm just going to read this to you from the book that I suggested. It's out in the description if you'd like to read it. But this is from page 49. It says, a Greek story claims that Nicholas had learned of an unfortunate family in Patara. This family had fallen on hard times, and the father, a widower, was preparing to sell the children into slavery. Now, let me pause here. When they say slavery, what they really mean is pretty much prostitution. If families couldn't afford to keep their family together, their daughters would often be sold into prostitution at this time and in this place. And so this father may lose his daughters to prostitution. It says Nicholas intervened anonymously. Keyword, anonymously, by secretly leaving enough money at their home for the children to be spared. While this story describes Nicholas as a giver of gifts, it might have happened that Nicholas, as a Christian priest, would have performed many such acts of kindness to relieve many unfortunate families and especially to rescue children, the most fragile of all. This was a moral obligation, particularly in view of the stark contrast between pagan and Christian values regarding children. An example of this contrast in value was the pagan practice of leaving unwanted newborn infants outside and exposed to the elements in the Christian abhorrence of such behavior. So this is the most basic form of this story. There are stories where it says the guy specifically had three daughters. Nicholas of Myra didn't want him to have to sell them into prostitution. And so out of the kindness and generosity of his heart, he leaves money for them overnight so they don't know where it came from, whether it was him throwing a bag of gold through the window, whether it was him putting money in shoes, whatever it may have been. He leaves this money overnight so they don't even know who did it. And this allows the family to stay together and stay out of slavery or prostitution. Now, like I said, this is the most basic story I just read, but there are other stories that say the three daughters were beheaded and Nicholas comes in and resurrects them. And it's all kinds of crazy myth developed. But the most basic story shows that out of the kindness of his heart, he intervenes to do what he can, and he keeps these girls from being sold into prostitution. Now, you can kind of see how this would have developed into our Santa Claus today, which we're going to get into in more detail in a few minutes. But he comes overnight, just like Santa comes overnight. He's generous, just like Santa's generous. He gives them a gift, not telling them who it is anonymously, just as we would say about Santa Claus today. So you can see how some of these things started to develop. And this is important because when people say that the idea of Santa Claus came from Odin, you'll see that they really don't have much in common at all. And Nicholas of Myra is most of the stuff you would say came from Odin is already fulfilled in Nicholas of Myra. So there's really no purpose of going there. But this is where the legend would have started to develop from a real man who actually existed, who actually walked the earth and led a very, not only faithful and generous and kind life, but also a very interesting life, especially the time he lived during. So really incredible. And you've probably seen, I couldn't go through a Santa Claus episode without touching on this, but you've probably seen memes and posts and stories and stuff like that about Santa Claus punching Arius in the face at the Council of Nicaea. Arius is the man who, of course, taught that Jesus was God's first and greatest creation. So he taught that Jesus was created and not actually truly God. Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons still believe this today. So there's a story going around, you probably see it every year, that Santa Claus punches Arius in the face at the Council of Nicaea. And maybe, depending on where you've seen it, they have like Santa Claus all jolly in the red suit, and he's just like, take this, Arius, boom, punches him in the face, bah, bah, bah. Yeah, well, anyway, this almost certainly isn't true. Okay, and I'll show you, and I'm saying almost certainly carefully. I didn't say certainly isn't true, but it almost definitely, for sure, certainly isn't true. Okay, now everyone likes a juicy story. Everyone likes drama, but this isn't it. Okay, it's pretty much clickbait. So if you look at where the story originated, it originated about 1,000 years after the Council of Nicaea. Now, does that mean it isn't true for sure? No, but it means it's not reliable. Okay, it came up 1,000 years later. There are some earlier lists that suggest that he was at the Council of Nicaea, and I think it's likely that he was there. I mean, he was a bishop during that time. He wouldn't have been too far from it. It's not unlikely that he was at the council, but that, first of all, the story actually says he slapped him, not that he punched him, but he almost certainly didn't do this. This probably didn't happen. Not only that, it doesn't reflect his character from what we know about him. And also, listen, I can't stand heretics as much as the next guy. I don't even play Bethel music, okay? But we don't punch heretics in the face. That's not something to celebrate, okay? That's not how Jesus handled it. He actually did quite literally the opposite. We shouldn't be cheering on people who are punching heretics in the face. Punch heresy in the face. You know, if you want to get it, I actually have a heresy shelf in my office. And I'm getting tired of it because I need some more space. So I'm thinking about burning them or something. I don't know. But then I'm a book burner. Then I'll be labeled a book burner. So I don't know what to do. But I don't want to punch these guys in the face. I just want their theology to be gone forever. That's just not how we handle things. So anyway, that's probably not true. Almost certainly didn't happen. So next time you can comment and say, not true in all caps or something like that. Put exclamation points and like a thumbs down emoji. That'll show them. So you have this real person in Nicholas of Myra with these traits that you see developed in a Santa Claus. So how did this happen? How did Nicholas of Myra become the legend of Santa Claus that we know today? Well, first of all, Santa in Spanish is saint, okay? And then Claus is a German variant of Nicholas, which again, happens to be my name. It means people of victory or victory of the people. And that's where Nike comes from, by the way. If you see a little Nike check mark, Nike comes from the word Nick. It means victory of the people or victory. And then, of course, Sinterklaas is the Dutch version of St. Nicholas. Why am I saying this? First of all, so you know what the word means, Santa Claus. Second of all, and this is really why, Santa is not the word Satan rearranged. If I hear one more person say that, I'm gonna faint and cry at the same time. Stop making up stupid things that make us look stupid. You're making all of our jobs harder, okay? Stop making up dumb things. Just stop. Just don't do it. If you hear something that sounds like, yeah, that's probably not true, then verify whether or not it's true before you go tell other people it or before you post it on your Facebook or before you do whatever. That's not what it means. Everyone knows what Santa means. It's already a word. It's saint. Okay? So anyway, an early form of Santa Claus first appears in print in America in 1773. Now, this, of course, is right before America gains independence, just 3 years later. This is, 16 years before they had their first president, George Washington. That was in 1789. So this is right at like the foundation, the heart of our country, when the core is just starting. And some people believe that this Santa Claus stuff here came intentionally at a time that America was searching for sort of their own identity and perhaps even their own American mythology. I mean, mythology has always been important to people. Legend has always been important to people, and it still is. And if you think about it, they wouldn't have wanted anything to do with English legend anymore, stuff that came from England. So they're kind of searching for, I think, their own identity. St. Nicholas of Myra wasn't English. And neither is the other stuff sort of associated with them. So it does make sense to me that they could have been searching for their own sort of American legend here that they wanted to carry on. I don't know if they thought that much into it, but still, it seems to make sense to me. And there are many who think that the modern, and this is what seems to be true, the modern version of Santa Claus probably began with a story written in the 1800s, which at the time was called A Visit from Santa Claus. But you've heard it by another name, and that's The Night Before Christmas. And I just said to my wife yesterday, actually, I just realized that The Nightmare Before Christmas is like a play on words with The Night Before Christmas. You probably knew that, but I didn't. So anyway, The Night Before Christmas at the time was called A Visit from Santa Claus. It was written in the 1800s in New York by a guy named Clement Clark Moore. So this is where the Santa Claus we know started. All of the stuff about him being jolly and coming at night and riding a sleigh and having the 8 reindeer, 9 if you include Rudolph, this stuff all came from this poem. And then in the 1930s, Coca-Cola is known for taking the idea of Santa and making it more marketable and more palatable. In fact, if you look up stuff about Santa Claus from before the 18 or 1900s, like, he looked like a bishop because Nicholas of Myra was a bishop. So you're either going to get a bishop, a very priest-like suit. Like if you've been to a Catholic church or a Greek Orthodox service, the stuff that the priest wears would have been very similar to what you'd see him depicted in. And so they took him and made him more marketable and palatable and jolly. Before that, it's either bishop-y or you'd even see like an elf-like or scary-looking guy. But they made this into a fat, jolly, nice, just guy. And so this is what Coke did. They solidified the jolly Santa Claus image. Now, going back to the Odin thing, Odin was a Greek god right before the turn of the... I think it was around 2 BC. So people like to say Santa Claus came from Odin. Again, I don't care where Santa Claus came from, okay? I don't care at all. Why would I care where Santa came from? But he didn't come from Odin. And the reasoning that people give for Santa Claus coming from Odin is all just not very well backed up. So they'll say Odin had an eight-legged horse named Sleipnir. Okay, well, Santa has eight reindeer. Same thing. Or not. How are you going to say just because a guy had an eight-legged horse that's the same thing as having eight reindeer? It's not. Okay, so spiders have eight legs. Multi-track tapes have eight tapes. You have the figure eight. Like, eight's not an uncommon number. This is not very strong evidence. People will say, well, Odin wears red. He looks like Santa. Well, that's wrong, too, because Odin actually wears blue. He didn't wear red. Odin isn't associated with gift-giving. The only gifts he gave, essentially, were weapons that he gave so that after he killed everybody, him and his army, they could take them all back. Okay, so there's really not a bunch of similarities between Odin and Santa Claus. And this is more of a thinking exercise than anything else, because sometimes we just hear something and we think somebody sounds educated, but really they just read it on like TikTok yesterday or they saw a video about it. Okay, so always good to question things. There's no causal connection. There's not a whole lot of link between Santa Claus and Odin. So with that being said, now that we've kind of arrived at where Santa came from, who he is, how he got to where he is today, at least generally, I wanted to talk about how to approach the idea of Santa Claus with kids. You know, what my wife and I do, what I would call it at least, is you have, on the one hand, full-blown Santa Claus, and then on the other hand, you have partial Santa Claus. Now, some of the dilemmas, and I'll explain that in just a second, that some of the dilemmas obviously surrounding Santa Claus are, number one, in order for your kids to believe in him, there's going to be times where you have to lie to them. I mean, you could kind of say, well, I can be vague and that's not necessarily lying. Well, that could be true for a time. But if your kids come up to you and say, Santa real, you're either going to have to choose, am I going to lie to them or not lie to them? So that's kind of the first part of the dilemma. The second part is the modern Santa Claus, his attributes are very similar to God. So for example, Santa Claus can pretty much be everywhere at once. He is virtually eternal, right? He always exists. He is constantly weighing and judging your behavior. So he's going to reward you off of your good or bad behavior. If you're bad, he's going to give you coal, which today would get you canceled. So it's even more harsh. That's not electric. So he was going to give you coal if you're bad. You have this whole sort of moral dilemma that kids have to... And it's good to teach kids good and bad, but it's also good at times to teach them that even when you're imperfect, you're still going to be loved, okay? Because that's what we get from the gospel. So you have this kind of the good and bad dilemma, Santa always knowing what you're doing. And then you have the potential or the danger for kids to sort of trust and adore Santa Claus more than they actually would God, because both of them have these very similar attributes, but one of them you're going to actually see the physical results of, like under your Christmas tree, if you're good. So those are kind of the dilemmas that you have to face, and we'll get into more detail. But these attributes are what I would assign to what I call the full-blown Santa Claus narrative. This is, like I just said, all the things I just said, the attributes, the having to lie to your kids at some point. These are things that come with the full-blown Santa Claus versus the partial Santa Claus, and that's how this can be defined a number of ways. Do it on your own, but for us it would be like, okay, well, you know, Santa Claus is obviously a big part of our culture. It's fun. So for us, what we've kind of chosen to do and are kind of doing now, our kids are really young. They're almost 2 years old and 4 months. So it's not like they have a full grasp of these things yet, but our son's pretty smart. Like, he knows his birthday's next month. He picks up on a lot, and kids listen a lot more than we think. We'll get more into kids in a second here, but what we've kind of decided to do is, okay, we'll do the fun stuff. We're not like anti-Santa Claus. There's no picture of him in our house or anything like that. You know, we don't take that route, but we do take the route of, you know, we're not going to raise him to think Santa Claus is actually this godlike figure who exists in the North Pole right now, who you can write to, who is judging and weighing your behavior, who's everywhere at once. So we're not going to take that route. We're just going to teach him it's kind of a fun thing at Christmas time that people like to do. And we're not going to tell him he actually exists. So we don't have to lie to him or anything like that. We're not going to raise him thinking Santa Claus actually exists. We're just going to teach him that it's a myth, sort of like, let's say like Narnia or one of his favorite shows. And this brings us to another sort of question slash dilemma. And that is that children can't really differentiate between myth and truth in this sort of setting, like a real life setting. And note, I did not say myth is bad in general. I actually don't think mythology is bad most of the time, at least in and of itself. If your kids watch Pokemon, unless they're going home and praying to Pokemon, I don't think it's bad if your kids watch Pokemon. If your kids watch Harry Potter, I don't think that's bad. If your kids watch Narnia, I don't think that's bad. If your kids watch Wingfeather Saga or Lord of the Rings, these are all things with elements of mythology. So I don't think mythology is bad. And actually, I think mythology can be used to teach our kids to understand truth. Harry Potter can teach them that there is a real, actual good versus evil. Narnia can teach them a lot about the reality of the gospel. And actually, it's really interesting that C.S. Lewis, one of the reasons he wrote Narnia, is he talks about this idea of like these watchful dragons guarding truth that they don't want us to know. Let me see if I can pull up the quote. But he essentially wanted to create this sort of like this different version of the gospel, but a different way to see the gospel, where kids would see it more imaginatively. And because of that, they would think about it in a different way that they had previously thought about it. And so they would through myth, they would learn actually more about the gospel than they would have otherwise, because we get used to hearing things like, oh, Jesus died on the cross, Jesus raised from the dead, Jesus died for my sin. But it's sort of just so repetitive and not well explained a lot of the time that people actually end up just hearing pretty much nothing when they hear that phrase. And so one of the reasons he wrote Narnia, which is myth, is that he wanted kids to understand the gospel better. I found the quote that I'll read really quick from C.S. Lewis. It says, "I thought I saw how stories of this kind could steal past a certain inhibition which had paralyzed much of my own religion in childhood. Why did one find it so hard to feel as one was told one ought to feel about God or the sufferings of Christ? I thought the chief reason was that one was told one ought to. An obligation to feel can freeze feelings. And reverence itself did harm. The whole subject was associated with lowered voices, almost as if it were something medical. But supposing that by casting all these things into an imaginary world, stripping them of their stained glass and Sunday school associations, one could make them for the first time appear, or could one make them for the first time appear in their real potency? Could one not steal past those watchful dragons? I thought one could." Now, many of you listening would probably agree that C.S. Lewis certainly achieved that. Okay, he caused us, whether children or adults, to think about the gospel in a different way than we may have otherwise. So I think this serves as a good example that myth is not bad. The difference in this situation is not that we're teaching kids myth or legend. I think the difference is that we are teaching kids that the myth itself is actually true. And we're indirectly, and I careful when I say this, okay, I understand I'm probably stepping a lot of toes. Most of us, I mean, I grew up with Santa Claus stuff, and most everybody I know did and does. And so I'm careful when I say this, but we're almost teaching them in a way to honor another God. And I know that we don't think of it this way, we don't do it intentionally, but when we take the attributes of who God is and we assign it to another figure and have our kids adore this figure and trust in this figure and try to behave in a way in order to please this figure, it can cause them to give devotion to this figure. Now, my wife and I are proposing that you can have all of the fun myth kind of stuff without actually teaching them that it's true. Without actually teaching them to believe in a godlike figure who they may give their devotion to in place of God or equal to God at very best. At this point, I can envision someone giving a counter argument. They might say, well, my kids were taught about Santa, I was taught about Santa, and now those kids are adults and it hasn't had any kind of negative impact on them. Maybe your kids are solid believers, maybe they're even in ministry. And this may be true probably for most people. Okay, I don't know a whole lot of people walking around today with like some kind of Santa Claus PTSD syndrome. Like, oh my gosh, I wish my parents didn't teach me about Santa. It's just messed me up. I can't worship God now. So that's not the reality. including me, by the way. I was raised believing in Santa Claus, like most of you were. So that's certainly not what I'm saying either. I think that's a fair point. However, how your kids think about God doesn't only matter when they're adults. It matters when they're kids too. And Jesus didn't just say, let the little adults come to me. Okay, he wants children to love him. He wants children to come to him. He wants children's undivided obedience and faith as much as he can get it. So if we're to raise them up in the way they should go, then that means raising them up in that way, not just raising them in another way and hoping they end up there. Does that mean you've failed your kids if you've taught them about Santa? No, of course not. It's very common in our culture. It's not out of the ordinary. The question here is not, have you failed your kids? The question here is not anything other than, what is the best option just looking at the facts? And what do we do with our kids? What do I do with my kids? So partial Santa, I think, is better than the full-blown Santa. I think it's a good compromise on the fun and cultural stuff without compromising on truth or having to lie to your kids. Now, another thing that I think is important is obviously we want Christ to be the focus at Christmas time, but I think it's also cool to teach your kids who Nicholas of Myra actually was as an example of Christ, as an example of how a Christian lives. I mean, was he perfect? No. I certainly wouldn't think so, but I think he's a very good example of how to reflect Christ with kindness, with commitment, with generosity. I mean, this is an awesome story that I'd like to see better known. Now, again, not in place of Jesus at Christmas time, but sort of like how we're, most of us are aware of a lot of early church figures, and he's not really recognized as one of them, though he really lived an incredible life. So I think that's another option too. And again, while of course we do want to teach kids that there's such a thing as good and bad, there is such a thing as right and wrong behavior, and I think primarily this comes through discipline and through teaching them how to do what's right, even against sometimes their own instincts, I also think we want to be careful to think they have to earn and deserve everything they have, especially in regard to the gospel. Now, this part, I think, does have truth to it when we get older. And I'm not blaming this on Santa Claus. Santa Claus, if you're actually real and listening, I hope you heard that. But I am saying that it's very simple for us, whether it's because we grew up in a certain religious framework, whether it's because we grew up just knowing that there's rewards for good and bad behavior, which isn't bad, by the way. I think it is hard for a lot of people to really grasp the gospel and to understand the concept of God gives me gifts and gives me good things because he loves me, period. There's nothing else. He doesn't give it to me because I've earned it. He doesn't give it to me because I haven't done too many good things. Not everything is behavior-based. Not every gift we receive is behavior-based. And in fact, for the most part, I think a gift probably really shouldn't be behavior-based, except for in some circumstances, maybe like a bonus at work or a raise or something like that. There are circumstances for that, of course, but I think it's just as crucial to help kids understand that when we give them a gift, it's not done by some godlike guy who lives far away. It's done by you because you love your kids. Just like we're given gifts from God because he loves us. We're given the gift of salvation, the gift of eternal life. We're given gifts every single day. Every time you look around, you can probably find 1,000. And he doesn't give them to you because you've done enough. He gives them to you because he's good and because he loves us. So that is a very real element. And I don't think that starts and stops with Santa Claus at Christmas. I think there's all kinds of things we do in life every day that might make it more difficult when we grow up for us to sort of grasp the gospel and really believe it and really embrace it. But it is one of the elements, I think. So a lot to go that goes into that. But these are just some of the main things that we think about. So we opt for a partial fun Santa Claus over the full-blown Santa Claus where we'd have to lie to our kids and teach them about a very sort of godlike figure. Now, with that being said, I did want to get into for a little bit here the idea of Santa Claus versus Jesus. And what I mean by that is if we know that Santa Claus, the modern Santa Claus today, who's a myth and legend, if we know that he developed from an actual historical person, Nicholas of Myra, well, then what do we do when scholars or even everyday people that you know say that the same thing happened with Jesus of Nazareth, that Jesus of Nazareth Yeah, sure. He was a historical figure. He was a real person. But all of this miracle, raising from the dead, all that God kind of stuff, that developed later as legend. That's sort of just myth and legend that was added to a historical figure, just like with the Santa Claus situation. Is the Christian's belief in Jesus just the same as a Santa Claus story, a real guy made into a legend? With Jesus of Nazareth, just a regular guy, slightly more than regular guy, maybe charismatic and outgoing, but because of Greek culture, of the Greek god culture, these myths and legends were sort of attached to him as a result. Well, how would you respond to that? First of all, I would think to ask a question. The question I would probably ask is, well, how and when did these legends develop? Keep in mind, most people, let's say they're not like a devout Christian believer, they may not know a whole lot about how the Bible came to be, about manuscript evidence, about how incredible the sources actually are. So the first thing I would do is I would ask, when would that legend develop? And this is actually a very strong argument for the resurrection. Because for people who think that Jesus was a historical figure and later on this whole resurrection from the dead stuff sort of developed as a legend or a myth attached to him, they probably don't know how unlikely that is and how little time there would have been for that to happen. And by how little time, what I mean is that it couldn't have possibly happened. Okay, so Jesus died and raised from the dead roughly somewhere around 30 AD, regardless of your view, okay? So somewhere around 30 AD. Well, there's a creed in 1 Corinthians 15 that may possibly go back to within months or even 2 to 3 years at the most of the resurrection. And even if it didn't go back that far, even if you deny that, like Bart Ehrman, for example, let's say 10 years later the creed came. Okay, 10 years? Is a legend going to develop in 10 years in the city where Jesus was crucified and buried? They would have just gone to the tomb and showed that he was in there. Okay, so there wasn't enough time for a legend to develop, especially in the actual city where it happened. Not to mention, you have 1 Corinthians itself written roughly 20 years after the resurrection. I mean, Galatians was written within 15. And these aren't written by people who just had a belief in what happened. These are written by eyewitnesses. Paul witnessed the risen Jesus after he raised from the dead, and Paul literally did a 180. His entire life transformed from going and killing Christians, from wanting nothing to do with Jesus other than to snuff his followers out, to all of a sudden writing half of the New Testament and devoting his entire life to the study and the proclamation of the gospel. You have the same thing with the rest of the apostles, the witness and tragedy of the apostles, who had no idea what Jesus was telling them when he kept telling them he had to die and resurrect. They had no idea what he's talking about, and they were shocked when he died. In fact, they were all hiding. So you have the same thing with the apostles. You have them telling and preaching these stories over and over after transforming their lives with nothing to gain, with being shipwrecked and beaten and tortured and hated. They gain nothing from this if we're talking about like a materialistic point of view here. But they still gave everything to proclaim not what they believe, but what they actually saw, what they witnessed with their own eyes, with what they touched with their own hands, and that was the risen Christ. So they all gave their lives. I mean, John was sent in exile to Patmos, but the rest of them all actually gave their lives for what they witnessed and gained nothing in return. So you have the issue of there not being enough time to develop a legend, and also the stories we have being written by either eyewitnesses who walked with Christ through his ministry or eyewitnesses of those eyewitnesses, like Luke, for example, or like Mark, who is most likely an apprentice to Peter. And then you have Luke, of course, following around Paul and other apostles. So you have eyewitness and eyewitness of eyewitness accounts. There's just not enough time or reason for a legend to develop. Now, let's say somebody were to say, okay, well, sure, maybe the Gospels and the New Testament letters were written not long after Christ, but how do we know that somebody didn't just come along and change them and add things to them over time? You know, maybe over the centuries, century after century after century, things just kind of changed a little at a time, or maybe during the Council of Nicaea under Constantine, a lot of these myths developed where Jesus was made into God. Well, the problem with that is we have tons of evidence and manuscripts from early church fathers and from scripture itself long before the Council of Nicaea. The Council of Nicaea was in the early 300s AD. Well, the earliest manuscript evidence we have is the P52 fragment, and it is most likely from within 20 to 30 years of when John was written. And it happens to talk about the divinity of Jesus. Go research that if you haven't, the P52 fragment. Again, Dan Wallace, when he was on, he talked about this. And there was one scholar who said the ink was most likely still drying. I don't know if it was a little bit of an exaggeration, but he said the ink may have been still drying when the manuscript, the actual handwritten original autograph from John was copied here. The ink might have still been drying. That's how new it was. So you don't have enough time for a legend to develop. And I think a lot of people think this legend and myth thing happened in regard to Jesus because they don't know these things. They haven't looked into the manuscriptural evidence. They haven't looked into when the Gospels were written or who they were written by. And as a result, I think they end up believing something that is just so verifiably not true. And we can enlighten them on that. We can show them the evidence. We can present the evidence to them and have them make the decision. And that's where I think a very, very helpful argument comes in. And again, C.S. Lewis, this is what was called the Lord Liar Lunatic argument. Now, he didn't invent this argument, but he's the one who's known for really making it famous. And the Lord Liar Lunatic argument is that Jesus couldn't have just been a good teacher. He couldn't even have just been a legend, actually, as we just talked about. He was either a lunatic, absolutely crazy and believed he was God. C.S. Lewis says, on the level of the man who thinks he's a poached egg. So he was either a total lunatic, or he was a liar. In other words, I'm going to tell people I'm God, but I'm not. I'm just lying. I have knowledge that I'm not God. Or the third option, he's actually Lord. There's no other option. He's either Lord, liar, or lunatic. That's what the evidence presents us with. So people can't just say there's not enough evidence and so I don't believe it or I think it was a legend. They have to demonstrate that. And on the other hand, they have to decide based not on the lack of evidence, but based on the evidence, is Jesus Lord, liar, or lunatic? He has to be one of those three. So I think that's a very timeless argument. I think it's an awesome argument to use, and it's easy to remember. Just remember LLL, Lord, Liar, Lunatic. So when somebody thinks or asks or brings up the idea that Jesus is just like Santa Claus in the sense that, yeah, he's a real historical figure, but myth and legend was later added, ask them when and how the legend developed, and then show to them that it couldn't have developed. And this could really go a long way. And this being an apologetic show, we're always thinking how you can use any situation for a discussion about the gospel and to defend the gospel and to present somebody with the gospel. This is a great way to do this around Christmas time. So I'd love to know your views on Santa Claus. If you disagree with something I said, send me an email at information@apologetics.org. I would love to know your views. I would love to know what you do, if you have some creative way of doing what I call the partial Santa Claus, what my wife and I have kind of come up with. Or I would like to know why you don't do that, if you do the full-blown Santa Claus stuff and if you've thought it through and you have a good reason. Maybe I haven't heard that reason, so send me that too. Send it to information@apologetics.org. And otherwise, we'll see you back here next Tuesday at 5 p.m., potentially before then. Look out for it. But otherwise, we'll see you back here next Tuesday, and I hope you have a blessed week and a blessed Christmas. If I don't talk at you before then, have a blessed week, and I'll see you next Tuesday at 5 p.m.